Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on modern science and Noah's Ark when we come back. You know, Charles Lyell was one of the modern pillars of society, especially in the area of geology, and he published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Now, Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated these ideas, but it was Charles Lyell. And it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins has been devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. And in that way, catastrophes like Noah's flood have been strictly ruled out. Now, this process is called science. Well, listen to this. The sun is shrinking. That was a Newswire report. Made a surprising statement. And it said, the sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century. Now, scientists have been watching for over 100 years, and the evidence is now conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking by about 5 feet. Now, if the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, then it totals 1% per millennium. If the sun existed only 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter. And only 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth. And as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent since the origin of the sun. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaurs' extinction? Now, wasn't that about 65 million years ago? Now, you know, we don't have to be rocket scientists to do the math on these kinds of pseudo-scientific lies. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda masquerading under the banner of science. And it's one more of the many lessons that we teach here in our Mosaic Law School, conducted twice a year here at the Law School in Isabella, Missouri. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first. That's the place to start. It doesn't cost anything. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, and it's entertaining. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we're talking about modern science and Noah's Ark. Now, the issue of the Ark has been bantied about all of my lifetime. I'm an old man now, and I can remember when I was a kid, people were arguing over the Ark, its size, its veracity. Was it true or false? How did it fit into evolutionary philosophy and so on? And I've observed in my lifetime that there are these three camps. I mentioned to you last time. I'll mention it briefly here. Three camps. You got the camp that doesn't believe the flood ever existed at all, period, end of report. We commonly call those scientists, agnostics, and skeptics, and evolutionists, and so on. Those are the unbelievers. Then we have the believers. These are the fundamentalist Christians. They believe that it occurred, it was universal, it was absolute, it was no doubt about it, and if it's good enough for Moses, it's good enough for me, and that's the end of that report. Now, those are the two extremes, and then in the middle, there is the modern consensus that, yes, there was a flood, but it wasn't universal, it wasn't worldwide, it was local. And that way, they can kind of straddle evolution and the Bible at the same time. So it's kind of a middle ground. So those are your three choices. Now, there could be a fourth, fifth, or sixth choice. If there is, I don't know what it is. Nobody ever told me, but I've observed those three. Now, there's a book here that I want to introduce you to. It's called The Genesis Flood. The Genesis Flood. Now, it's a scientific treatise. It's written by two scientists, one a doctor of theology named Whitcomb, and the other a hydrologist by trade. He's a professor of hydrology. That's the study of water. And his name is Morris, Henry Morris. And back in 1961, they wrote a scientific treatise. It's a little difficult to read, to be honest with you. In fact, when I first picked this book up back in the 1960s, I had to go through the first chapter or two and actually decode it. So I picked up a dictionary, and then I started reading the book. And then as I read the book, I found that there were words like anthropologically, geographically, and hyper-orthodox and anthropological. You know, these are words that you just normally don't run into in your everyday funny pages, you know. When I'm reading Buck Rogers or B.C. or Charlie Brown, you know, I don't run across words like that. And so I had to translate the book. I don't know why these authors think that they have to use these kinds of big words, but, you know, for whatever reason, they do. And so I want to just warn you up front, you know, you'll need a dictionary for the first, not the first chapter. The first chapter is pretty straightforward, but after you get into the book and you get into the science portion, then after you get to translate about 100, 200 words, maybe 300, you'll start to pick up the lingo a little bit. And then when you, and then I wrote in right above these like anthropological, you know, and the geographical, I wrote up the common definition of it right above it. Then I could go back and read the chapter with the common definitions of these words so I can understand it, you know, in longshoreman's terms, in truck driver terms. So I just wanted to warn you about that. Now the book, last time I checked, is still in print. I've got the hardback version. It was first published by the Presbyterian and Reformed Publishing Company of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in 1965. Now that's the edition that I have. It was first published in 1961. It was a college-level textbook. And the first printing was in February of 61. The seventh printing was in April of 65. And it's got a Library of Congress catalog card number at 60-13463. That's called the Library of Congress catalog card number 60-13463. Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris. Probably the most extensive pro-biblical treatise on the subject of the deluge and Noah's Ark that's in literature today, probably. Now, there's lots of books out there written, you know, about the Great Flood and so on. Most of them are in opposition to it. They're evolutionary textbooks. They ridicule it, make fun of it, and so on. Now, I said last time, let's take a look and apply the rules of evidence to it. You know, from the point of view of a lawyer and a judge, could I come into court with Genesis 6, 7, and 8, and could I present this as evidence in court to prove my issue, and then present that to a jury, have the jury consider it, and give me a verdict? And the answer is yes, I could, and I showed you that last time. Simon Greenleaf, you remember the Simon Greenleaf book? It's called The Testimony of the Evangelist, and in the book he gives you the six rules of evidence that we use to test parole evidence, testimony, oral testimony of witnesses. And I showed you the Kwok Ting test. You remember that Kwok Ting test? Okay. Kwok Ting came from a court case, 1891. And I gave you the citation. If you didn't get it down now. Because we're going to use these tests here to prove our point. Kwok Ting, see if I got the number here. Come on, George. Here it is. It was decided on May 11th, 1891. And it's cited at 140 U.S. 417. 140 U.S. 417. And it's called Kwok Ting, Q-U-O-C-K. Kwok is a Chinese guy. Ting, T-I-N-G. Kwok Ting versus U.S. Three standards that we use to prove whether or not oral testimony is correct. Number one, testing must be complete. That is the testimony that you're giving. The test has to be complete. The testimony must contain extemporaneous detail. And three, the testimony must be supported by witnesses and evidence. Not witnesses or. It's witnesses and. You got to have both. Those are the three tests. Now, there's another neat book over here I want to give you, and it's called The Harmony of Science and Scripture by Harry Rimmer. He's a DD and a DSC. He's a Doctor of Divinity and has a doctorate in science. It was published by Erdmann's Publishing Company, Grand Rapids, Michigan, back in 1936, and it's called The Harmony of Science and Scripture. The guy's name is Harry Rimmer, and a good guy. I'm not knocking him at all, but Harry Rimmer subscribes to the local flood theory. He's in the middle ground here. See, he's opposed to evolution, and he's pro-Bible, but subscribes to the doctrine, the idea, that, well, there was a flood, but it was local in nature, and it wasn't worldwide. Kind of an apologetics, I call this Christian apologetics. He's trying to apologize for God. God made a mistake here, and so we're going to fix it for him. I don't think God made a mistake. I think God got it right the first time, told us what he saw, what he heard, what he knew, gave us a testimony, wrote the testimony down, made a sworn affidavit. I don't know if you understand this or not, but as a matter of law, the Bible is a sworn affidavit. And the testator said, I've sworn by my own self, because there's none other higher to swear by than me. And when we go into court today, we swear an oath to God to judge our testimony. So here's the guy that you're swearing by. He came in. He also took an oath. He said, I'm going to swear by my own self. I'm not going to put my hand on the Bible, raise my hand, and swear an oath. He says, I'm going to swear by my own self that the testimony I'm giving you is the truth. Now, of course, to the evolutionist and the skeptic and the agnostic and so on, he says, poppycock, I don't believe it. Okay, so let's understand something about belief versus proof. You see, there was a time, once upon a time, long ago and far away, when men believed that the earth was flat. You can read about that in history. Now, over a long period of time, and by various and many scientific means, we have now come to the conclusion, if you've been educated like I have, that the world is not flat, but rather it is round. Although it does appear to be pretty flat. Now, you can get out here in Illinois, and just kind of driving down the highway, you know, in Illinois, and you can observe by your own senses how flat the land is. So I've done that a time or two. And it is true that it does appear to be flat. Just like in a sandbox to an ant, the sandbox appears to be the whole scope of all that exists. Until you get up on the fence and you look out and you can see that, no, the sandbox isn't everything that exists. There's something more out there past the sandbox. Now, the ant doesn't know what's out there beyond the sandbox because he doesn't have the vantage point to make the observation. And so it's understandable that the ancient Egyptians and Babylonians and ancient peoples believed that the earth was flat because based upon what they could see, they could walk up on top of a mountain and they could look out and it looked pretty flat as far as they could see. And so they came to a conclusion, so, well, the world's flat. Now, we've come to a little bigger observation point. Somebody got off out into space there in a spaceship called Challenger and took some pictures of planet Earth, and now we can see that it indeed is round. In fact, we probably could have come to the conclusion that it was round by just looking at the sun and the moon. And, you know, you just look up there at the moon, and you can see that it's pretty round. And it should have led people to the conclusion that, well, maybe the Earth looks kind of like the moon, or, you know, maybe the Earth is round like the sun. We could see those two orbs in the sky. For some reason, for thousands of years, we never came to that conclusion. Now, if back in the days when people believed that the Earth was flat, you'd come along and said, no, I think the Earth is round, you'd have been on the outside looking in. People would have said, you're nuts. You know, you're really stupid, uneducated, uninformed. And they would bring forth their proofs. They'd take you up on top of the mountain and say, look out there. What do your eyes see? Well, your eyes see flat ground. Okay. And they'd say, now you see, the world is flat. Okay. Now, sometimes what we see is deceptive, and sometimes what we hear and what we've been told isn't all of the truth. It can have some truth or no truth at all, or it can be all true. Every statement is 100% true, but the conclusion can be false. And that's just the way life is. Now, if I came to you and I said airplanes exist and that people can fly, you'd look at me and you'd say, so? What else is new? But if I'd have made that statement that man can fly, in 1863, let's say, over the Gettysburg battlefield. Now they had balloons. They did have observation balloons. And they've been around for a long time. And you think, well, yeah, man could fly in a balloon. And I'd say, no, man could fly in a heavier-than-air configuration. See, you might have said, well, now that's getting into witchcraft and heresy, and that's not scriptural, and that's not religious, and that's not in the Bible, and blah, blah, blah. And but that doesn't mean that the statement is untrue. In fact, the laws of thermodynamics, the laws of aerodynamics were already in force and effect in 1863, and indeed in 1863 BC. They might not have been known, understood, or comprehended, but that doesn't mean that they didn't exist. It was possible for people to fly back in 1863 BC. It was possible to fly in 1863 AD. They didn't know how to do it, and they couldn't carry it out, but the laws were there. Now, a lot of times people are objecting here to miracles. See, miracles. And sometimes we call this the miracle of flight. And it is kind of a miracle. And I can remember one time I was out on the taxiway. First time I'd ever seen anything like this in my life. It was back about 1972, I believe, 71 or 72. And I had just returned from Alaska, and I was flying a Cherokee 6. And I had landed at Seattle-Tacoma Airport for fuel. You know, and I fueled up and taxied out here to the runway. And I'm sitting here at the end of the runway. And I'm holding for a plane that's coming in, see? And I'm looking at this dot in the sky out here, you know, way, way out there, you know, 10, 15 miles. And as it's coming in, it's getting bigger and bigger. And as I'm witnessing this airplane coming in for a landing, it's going to occur right in front of my eyeballs. And it was a 747, first time I'd ever seen one. I mean, I saw pictures of them, you know. And I saw them on television, just like you do. But I've never seen one of those things live and direct and up front. Now, when this airplane is coming in for a landing, it's coming in with full flaps. And it's got the gear down, and he's coming in with full flaps, and he's coming in slow. Now, this airplane is actually coming in at about 180 miles an hour, which is just about 20 miles an hour faster than this airplane I'm flying can fly at full bore. I mean, to get 180, I got to go into a nosedive to get that fast. This guy is slowing it down to 180, making his approach. And when that airplane flew across the front of my windshield, I just gasped. I didn't think anything that big could fly. But I watched it. By God, it was right in front of my eyeballs. And I saw it and I witnessed it. Now, I could have written that down. I could have given you my eyewitness testimony. Now, if I'd have done that and handed that maybe to an Aboriginal out in New Guinea, you know, maybe he'd never seen anything like that, and told him, gave him my report, wrote it up, swore to it, took it in front of a notary, would he believe my report? Probably not. Probably not. But so what? Does it make my report false because this Aborigine doesn't believe my report? All right, so now we need to understand something. It doesn't make any difference whether you believe the report or not. Your belief has absolutely nothing to do with the truth or the falsity of the report. Nothing. It's irrelevant. Totally irrelevant. And as I mentioned to you, I said, you know, most men are liars. In fact, the scripture says all men are liars. And so I'm going to go with the scripture, and, you know, and that's pretty true. All men are liars. I showed you that in tests, we can demonstrate that when you testify, and you intend to testify to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and it just happened recently, and you go to testify to it, 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth will be false. And that's when you're trying to tell the truth. Now, we've tested that. Professor Swift started the ball rolling, and we do that to this day. We call this psychology. Now, people are pretty careful, and they try to tell the truth, and they try to give the facts. But eyewitness testimony, it has been demonstrated over and over again, is the least reliable evidence that you can present in court. Now, there is evidence that we can rely upon. It's scientific. Scientific evidence is that kind of evidence that you can demonstrate mathematically. Mathematically. You can do it over and over again. So when we're looking for proof or the truth of the proof that is being submitted into evidence, the truth of the proof submitted into evidence, we have what we call mathematical certainty. That is, we have the DNA. We have the rape victim's testimony, and we have the confession of the rapist. And all three agree that this is the rapist, that's the victim, and this is the semen sample. That's called mathematical certainty. There isn't any doubt in anybody's mind for any cause or reason. The second level of proof is called reasonable doubt. Reasonable doubt. Now, reasonable doubt means that the rapist denies that he raped the victim, but the victim says that he did rape her, which reduces the controversy to he said, she said, and then we bring in the semen sample, maybe even supported by a DNA sample, maybe even supported by a blood test. And all of the scientific tests can point directly at this one individual, but it's not quite a mathematical certainty. And when we look at DNA, it says, well, out of 6 billion people, we can reduce this to 6. There are 6 men in the world that could have this same DNA sample, the same sequence. So it's something less than a mathematical certainty, but, you know, is this one of the 5 guys in the world that could have this same DNA? We reduce that by bringing in the blood sample and the semen sample. And then we cross-reference those 3, and we say, oh, well, ain't quite, you know, this guy could have the same blood type as one of these other 5. You know, it isn't quite mathematically certain, but we get to a point where the probability of this guy being the guy that did it against him being innocent is so great that it's proved beyond a reasonable doubt. All right, now there's a third standard. It's called the preponderance of evidence. Preponderance of evidence. Now, the preponderance of evidence is what we call circumstantial. We put a lot of factors together. And we would say, well, all rapists are men, and this guy is a man. Therefore, there's one piece of evidence that would indicate that he's the rapist. Except that one half of all the people in the world are men, and so therefore we have to consider that he's 1 out of 3 billion. So, you know, the odds are 3 billion to 1. Okay. So we add a little bit more to that. We come up to the victim can't identify the guy, but we do have the DNA sample, which narrows it down to one man out of six, out of a population of 6 billion. That narrows it down. It ain't a mathematical certainty. And there is some reasonable doubt. There's 5 other guys it could have been. But, you know, we would add to that one more piece of circumstantial evidence. The guy that did this has type B blood, and the semen sample tests type B. All right, now, he denies it. She doesn't know. But we have the DNA sample. And we have the fact that he is a man, and he has all of the equipment. He's equipped for rape. Penis, testicles, you know, man, hair. Okay. So we put a circumstantial case together. We call this the preponderance of evidence. We typically don't try to use preponderance of evidence in a criminal case. These are typically civil. But I just wanted to point out that you got mathematical certainty. There's no doubt in anybody's mind. You got reasonable doubt. There could be another answer. There are some people locked up in prison convicted beyond a reasonable doubt. They're innocent. And it's a big number. It's about 15%. And then there's the preponderance of evidence rule over here that says, well, could be, probably is, looks like it, but it's circumstantial. And so we try not to use that in criminal cases so that we don't lock the wrong guy up. All right, now we're going to apply these three standards to Noah's flood. How's that? And we're going to do that right after this break where I tell you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on Compact Disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, be sure to order yours by calling and asking for it. So all you have to do is call up and say, send one of those to me. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Let's all keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about science and Noah's Ark. Now, the reason I've laid this background for you is so that we can understand, I'm not trying to persuade anybody that my view is correct. What I'm trying to do is show you what the standards are that we use in the judicial process to establish as to whether or not these facts are true, accurate, incorrect, or probably true, accurate, incorrect, or mathematically certain to be true, accurate, incorrect. Okay. I'm going to take the position that not only cannot the evolutionary science community, and when you put the word science in there for them, prove that this is false, but I can prove that it is true. And it's what we call proving the negative. So first of all, let's understand that whether you believe something to be true or false is not proof. That's an opinion. And opinions don't count. And that's the bottom line. In law, opinions don't count. It is true that an opinion from an expert witness can be used in court for the purposes of establishing a connecting link, to establish probability, to clarify facts, to give the fact finder some understanding so that he can arrive at a conclusion. That's true. Expert opinion does have a place. But the expert witness is a paid professional liar. And hell, everybody knows that. You know, you get one expert psychologist, he comes in and he testifies that the defendant over here is sane. And able to stand trial, and he knew what he was doing, and he knew, and he was cunning, and he was deliberate. Then the defendant comes in with his psychologist or his psychiatrist and testifies, oh no, this guy was temporarily insane. He was out of his mind. He didn't know what he was doing, and he's legally insane, and therefore you got to cut him loose. Now, both of these witnesses that come in can't be right. I mean, the guy was either insane or he wasn't. You know, you can have expert witnesses. They may be hydrologists and scientists, and they're knowledgeable people. But everybody has an opinion, and opinions don't count. Bottom line, opinions don't count. So no matter where you stand on the issue, I believe in the local flood, I believe in the worldwide flood, I don't believe in any flood at all, you've got an opinion. So let's take a look at your opinion, and let's analyze your opinion based upon the rules of evidence. Let's take a look at it, let's cross-examine it. And let's look at our arguments pragmatically, and let's see, well, where does it fit? Is it provable beyond a reasonable doubt? Is it provable with a preponderance of the evidence? Or is it a mathematical certainty? Now, I'm going to leave it up to you to make your decision. I'm not here to tell you what to believe. I'm just here to present the evidence. You're the juror. You listen to the evidence, and you say, well, where does it come out? Let's start with Whitcomb and Morris on the Genesis flood. We'll start here with page 1, where they point out that there's a basic argument here for a universal flood. Then in page in chapter 2 and 3, they present the basic arguments against this universal flood. Now, I can't cover the entire 300-page book. Let me just take a look and see how many pages are. No, it's bigger than that. It's 514 pages. 515 pages. 518 pages. Okay, it's 518 pages. We're not going to cover all that in one subject. But what we're going to do is we're going to take some pieces of evidence out. And then I'm going to present that evidence to your mind. And then we'll let you decide, well, what do you think of that? Now, one of the evidences here for the flood, in fact, there are 7 evidences here presented in this chapter. So we want to take a look at, number 1, the depth of the flood. Number 2, the duration of the flood. Number 3, the geology of the flood. 4, the size of the ark. 5, the need for the ark. 6, the testimony concerning the ark. And then, number 7, the total destruction of man from the flood. Now, if we could take those 7 topics, and then if we could apply the rules of evidence, what would the conclusion be when we get to the end? Okay. So sit back, relax, and let's start presenting our evidence. In harmony with our conviction that the Bible is the infallible Word of God, verbally inspired in the original autographs, we begin our investigation of the geographical extent of the flood with 7 biblical arguments in favor of its universality. Okay? Now, they're going to come up with 7. I got 48. 48 reasons why the flood was universal. Now, Whitcomb and Morris start off by saying, well, we're not going to present 48. We're going to present 7. Now, these are the best 7 out of the 48. Okay? The first one is the depth of the flood. One of the most important biblical arguments for a universal flood is the statement in Genesis 7, verses 19 and 20. It says, and the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all of the high mountains that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. Did you catch that? Now, here's the testimony. Now, we don't know if this testimony is true or not. We haven't got to that point yet. But the witness here in the affidavit said that the mountains were covered. All right. Somebody's going to say, do you mean to tell me you believe that Mount Everest was covered 29,035 feet deep with water here on planet Earth? I've had people say that. Excuse me. Let me bring this to your attention. Do you think that Mount Everest was existent the day the flood began? Because geologically we can show that Mount Everest didn't exist and that mountain building is still going on. And in 1953, Mount Everest was 29,000. And 3 feet high, 29,000, 3 feet. The last time I saw a number on Mount Everest, it was 29,035 feet. It has grown 32 feet between 1953 and today. Now let's see how fast it's growing. From 53 to 03 is 50 years, so we're talking about 55 years here. In 55 years, it has grown, well, let's just test this, here's 55 years divided by 32 feet, isn't it? Is that right? Yeah, 32 feet. So it's growing at the rate of, well, wait a minute, I got that backwards here, 35 feet. Let's go 35 times 12 inches is 420 inches. So it grew 420 inches divided by 55 years, or 7.6 inches a year. Mount Everest is rising at the rate of 7.6 inches a year. Mountain building is still going on. My God, there's evolution for you. Evolution's just still going on. Now, the aftermath of Noah's flood is still going on. We haven't gotten to the end of the destruction of Noah's flood yet. That's what you're observing. So just so that you'll know that the mountains are still growing and that the earth is fairly young, geologically speaking. There's another line of proof here. If you take the rate of erosion going on in the world today, I don't know if you've ever thought about erosion, but every year the rivers like the Amazon River, they're muddy, and then they're carrying silt down the river and out into the ocean. And the delta of the Mississippi River, it's bigger today than it used to be 100 years ago, 200, 300. In fact, it's growing, and there's the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey, and they go around the world, all over the world, and they measure the growth of these river deltas. They measure the sediments in the rivers, and they're watching that. They've been measuring it for a long, 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 long time. You want to know something? Here's the answer. If you take the erosion that's going on in the world today and you extrapolate it into the future, the world is going to wear down through erosion, and it will be as smooth as a billiard ball in 14 million years. Isn't that special? That's just real special. 14 million years. Now, if we apply uniformitarianism to that, which is what evolutionists tell us, there isn't any scientific basis for this, but I just want to tell you that this is what they tell us, and then they call this science. This is the BS that's called science. They tell us that what is going on today has been going on forever. Time passed. Whatever you see going on today, that's been going on forever, and that's called uniformitarianism. There isn't a shred of evidence to back that up. You can't demonstrate that in the classroom. You can't demonstrate that in the laboratory. We haven't got a clue if that's true or not. That's an opinion. There's absolutely no scientific basis for that whatsoever. None. It's just an opinion. It may be true. But the erosion rate may have been double what we see today 10,000 years ago. It may have been half of what we see today 30,000 years ago. And we don't have any reliable way. We don't have any witnesses, evidence, or testimony that we can bring in here to tell us what the erosion rate was in times past. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's assume that uniformitarianism is 100% true, accurate, and correct. What we see today has been going on for 14 million years in the past. If that's true, then the world should be as flat as a billiard ball today, boys and girls. Because it's going to be as flat as a billiard ball in 14 million years. Well, then obviously uniformitarianism has not been going on for 14 million years at the same rate that it's going on today. Because the world is not flat as a billiard ball. In fact, the mountains are still growing. I'm just reporting what these guys are telling you. Let's take a look at another example here of this BS that masquerades under the guise of science. Remember, I started off today's program and I said the sun is shrinking. Where in hell did I get the idea the sun is shrinking? I don't know that. I have never conducted a single experiment on the sun. I've never viewed it through a telescope. I wouldn't know how. I haven't got a clue. I don't doubt it. This is a report that was reported in a newspaper based upon some reporter went out and interviewed some scientist, or 5 or 10, I don't know how many he interviewed, but went out here and he said, hey, what's going on? What are you doing? How are you spending the taxpayers' money? And the scientist said, well, I've been watching the sun. How long have you been watching the sun? For 100 years. What did you see? The sun is shrinking. The hell do you beller? The sun is shrinking. Yeah. Now, when I was a kid, they didn't tell us that the sun was shrinking. They said it isn't going to burn up because it's got this or that or something. We had a theory 70 years ago when I was a kid. Well, the theories change. The science textbooks change. Yesterday's science is today's laughingstock. Go look at a science book 70 years ago and see what it says and then compare it to today. That's why you don't have science books in the classroom today that are 70 years old, because they're nonsense. The Bible's still here, by the way. Still making its same pronouncements. Hasn't changed one iota in the last 3,000 years. Well, at least the Old Testament did. But bottom line to all of this, when we analyze it, science then is observation. And they have observed the sun is shrinking. And they reported it to us. And they said it's shrinking 1% per millennium. Well, okay, apply uniformitarian to that. 100,000 years ago, the sun, which is 750,000 miles in diameter today, would be 1.5 million miles in diameter 100,000 years ago. Was the sun there 100,000 years ago? Of course it was. Haven't you been listening to Carl Sagan? Billions and billions of years ago was the Big Bang. And then came punctuated equilibrium. Okay, well, Big Bang is nice, and punctuated equilibrium is twice as nicer. But those are opinions and theories and ideas that people have about something they know nothing about. Trouble was, we don't have any reliable evidence or witnesses from 4 billion years ago or 3 billion years ago or 100,000 years ago who can testify to these facts. And the one observer that we do have, God, who testified to these facts by affidavit and swore by himself and said that this is true, accurate, and correct, we don't believe. Well, I'm not here to get you to believe him. I didn't tell you to give your heart to Jesus. I said, let's apply what he said to what we know and what we can see and observe, and then let's see if we can come to an intelligent conclusion. So let's do it. The sun is shrinking. We can observe it shrinking. It shrinks by 1% per millennium. Well, that's what they tell us. I don't know that, you don't know that, and neither does half the other people in the world, but I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. I'll believe every damn word, because that's what the rules of evidence require. The rules of evidence say, well, if the guy comes in here and says that the sun is shrinking by 1%, the burden's on me to prove it isn't. I couldn't prove it one way or the other. I don't even have a telescope. And I never went to college, got no degrees, can't prove jack diddly squat. So, just as one of the rules of evidence says, well, I guess I got to accept it. And I do. I'm just telling you. That's what he said. That's his testimony. He can come in here, raise his hand, swear to God. I don't know why you evolutionists come in and swear an oath. And I don't understand why you religious people come in and swear an oath either. The only book that I know of on planet Earth that tells you not to swear is the Bible. Everybody comes in, swears on the Bible. What I'm going to tell you is the truth. You can believe me. The Bible's the only book in the world that says every man's a liar. And these people come in, raise their hand, swear to God, I'm telling you the truth. I walked in the last program and said, well, and count me out of that group. I'm a pathological liar. I lied in the past. I lied recently. I'm probably going to lie in the future. You don't want to believe anything I tell you. So I said, let's see if we can prove what I'm telling you. Now let's see if we can apply some science to this and say, well, now, Gordon, can you prove what you're saying? I think I can. Going back here, the sun is shrinking. 100,000 years ago, using uniformitarianism, which has been testified to by many, many scientists and so on, it's true. That's what they tell you. Now, what you see going on today has been going on forever. Okay, let's take their testimony and apply it. If the sun is shrinking by 1% every millennium, that's every 1,000 years, and you just start adding the numbers up, let's go back 20 million years. Okay? If we went back, as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent since the origin of the sun. If the sun existed 100,000 years ago, it would be double its present size. 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth. All right? That's what the arithmetic tells us. Now, I checked this out on my Sharp EL1197G3 from Texas Instruments. Now, by God, if you can't believe your Sharp EL1197G3, you need to quit. And I checked it out, and those numbers, check out, they're right. Now, boys and girls, the Earth revolves around the sun. We used to think the sun revolved around the Earth, but then we found out the Catholics weren't telling us the truth, and that the Pope didn't quite understand as much science as he thought he did. Now, since then, we've come to the conclusion that the Earth is rotating around the sun. Furthermore, they've measured the distance between Earth and the sun, and they figured out it was about 93 million miles. Okay. Now, it's 93 million miles to the sun. Write that down. Get your pen out here. Write down 93 million miles. Okay. Now, if the sun is shrinking 5 feet an hour, if we were to go back in time and add 5 feet an hour for 20 million years, how big would the sun be? And the answer is it would be 93 million miles in diameter. Or. Well, if that was the case, then the Earth would be exactly on the surface of the sun, wouldn't it? 20 million years ago. Well, then that means that the Earth had to have been created at some time after 20 million years ago, didn't it? 21 million years ago, the sun was more than 93 million miles in diameter. Or the Earth was further away from the sun, and it's constantly getting closer to the sun. You know, something happened. All right, now, I went to school just like you boys and girls did, and my teachers told me and showed me the four-color slick pages, and then told me that the dinosaurs on planet Earth died out 65 million years ago when a comet hit the Yucatan Peninsula. Do you remember that story? All right. Remember I said a little earlier, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do this kind of arithmetic. Hell, us plumbers, carpenters, and electricians, and truck drivers, and longshoremen can do this. Any of us can. Now, either one of two things don't jibe here. When you have two witnesses that come in and testify like this in court, and one witness says, billions and billions of years ago, and another scientist comes in and he testifies that the Earth is shrinking at the rate of 5 feet an hour. Or excuse me, the sun is shrinking at the rate of 5 feet an hour, and the Earth is 93 million miles from the sun, and we get these factors down here, and we start putting some numbers together. Remember the Kwok-Ting test I told you about? What we have to have is extemporaneous testimony. We have to have testimony has to contain extemporaneous detail. Now, when we apply the extemporaneous detail to this story, what does it tell us? Huh? It tells us it's poppycock. And, I mean, these guys are teaching us in school. Now, leaving aside the question, Are they teaching that to your little children in school today? Hell, that's what they taught you in school yesterday. Well, let's pay attention. Grow up and be big boys and girls now. We were lied to. This is not true, accurate, and correct testimony. Now, it could be that the guy that's taking his measurements of the sun over here has made a mistake, and his numbers aren't correct. Or it could be that the guy who's telling us that the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago because of a comet there, an asteroid that hit the Yucatan Peninsula, maybe he's in error. Maybe it wasn't 65 million years ago. Maybe it was sooner than that. But boys and girls, somebody here has to change his story, because both of these stories cannot be true. Now, we're going to apply these same standards here to this testimony that we've gotten here in the Scripture. And I wanted to start out with these basic arguments for a universal flood, and I'm going to take seven of them. Okay, I'm just going to take seven. We'll do this next time because I'm running out of time here. And we're going to take this depth of the flood, which it says here was 15 cubits deep. Now, 15 cubits is 22 feet, the highest mountain. Well, the highest mountain on planet Earth at that time, I don't know how high the highest mountain on planet Earth was when Noah got into the boat. I don't know if it was 1,500 feet above sea level, 15,000 feet above sea level, or 150 feet like it is down in Florida. I can't tell you because I don't know. But then neither does anybody else. So we got to have an eyewitness. But the eyewitness says that the highest mountain, whatever its elevation, was buried in water 22 feet deep. Now, you don't have to be real smart to figure out if the highest mountain on planet Earth was buried under 22 feet of water, that flood was worldwide. Hell, even a plumber can figure that out. All right, boys and girls, we're about out of time again, so let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night.